Chris Sheridan.
Jason Napolitano. Greetings.
Oh, that was a cheery greeting. I wasn't expecting that on a quiet Sunday. Thank you for that.
Yeah. I'm feeling my energy's up for this show today.
Clearly. All right. Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. We're just going to jump right into this with Chris bringing so much energy to the forefront right away. I am your host, Jason Napolitano. And as I said, I have on the phone Chris Sheridan. Chris is the author of The Spirit in the Sky. I am the author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. Today, we are going to talk about music, the esoteric, spirituality, connections to music, rock and roll, etc. We might talk a little bit about Pythagoras. I'm sure we'll get into some Manly Hall secret teaching somewhere in there. We're going to let the spirit of music lead us where it will. Speaking of music, on a sad note, Chris lost a friend, Lizzie Gray, who is a beloved member of the Los Angeles music scene, and we wanted to just pay our respects to him. He died last Sunday. So, Chris, if you wanted to talk a little bit about that before we start the show, please do.
Well, sure. And thank you for the opportunity. It's worth mentioning if you're ever interested or have had an interest in the 80s, even the 70s in L.A., the Sunset Strip music scene with all the glam bands and hair bands that came out of that era. There was one very central band in that whole recipe called London, and that was Lizzie Gray, my singer, who just passed at age 60. Back in 79, he started that band. Nikki Sixx from Motley Crue was the bass player. And if you watch the Motley Crue movie on Netflix, you see, they show the London band playing in the early part of it as part of the history. And throughout the span of the London band, members from Mott the Hoople, from Guns N' Roses, like Izzy Stradlin and Slash, both played in the band. Blackie Lawless from Wasp, Fred Coy from Cinderella. It was almost like a who's who. Had some, it's like doing a Roger Corman film, it's at some point you kind of got to do one and you have to spend a few months in London and then you go on to do great things. But ironically, Lizzie never really got the national attention. He got a lot of respect because people knew who he was throughout all that time. But it seems like the other people that played in this band got a bit more fame and fortune along with it. But he kept playing, and I started playing with him in his most recent band, Spiders and Snakes. Shortly after I joined the band, it's about 7 or 8 years ago, 7 years ago, I noticed he was having trouble playing guitar on some of the parts. And then he had me do most of the leads, and he would just play rhythm. And then it got worse and worse, and he was diagnosed with Parkinson's, Lewy body, which is really mysterious diseases of neurology that's seems to be going around a lot. Not sure how he got it and was never really able to find treatment that did more than just sort of help him sustain life longer. And it got so bad that he couldn't even play guitar anymore. And the last time we went in the studio, he sat next to me and he would sing the guitar parts that he heard in his head. And then I would go like this, blink, blink, blink. And he's like, no, that's not it, a little more. And then we finally got this communication together where I could sense what he was trying to describe. And he confirmed that I was nailing what he had in mind. So, and then he could still sing. He still had enough body power to sing. And
okay, great.
He's just somebody that, really helped out a lot of people, great body of work, music. And that's the thing about most of our topics, today is on music. That's something he did really until he died. Even just as short as 2 weeks ago, he was talking to one of his other old bandmates about getting together and re-recording some of the songs, which he still at that time, even just a couple weeks ago, had the energy for. And it was just a very quick downturn but the music lives on. We have recorded music, and his music can live on, and that's the important thing.
Is there some of his stuff up on YouTube? Could the listener find London songs and Spiders and Snakes songs up there?
You can find a bunch of stuff, but there was such a span of time, I think he had Spiders and Snakes 20 years. I was only in the band 7 years.
But, okay.
So there's a lot of releases, a lot of different versions of things. But if you want the early London, actually listen to Motley Crue's first record. There's a song called Public Enemy that that Nikki Sixx and Lizzie wrote together. That's that's still on the Elektra Motley Crue, Too Fast for Love, their debut album.
All right, fantastic.
So that's kind of a, and that bridges both. You know, Nikki took it to Motley Crue, but it was a song that he and Lizzie wrote in London before Nikki started Motley Crue. So,
fantastic. All right, well, Lizzie, rest in peace.
Yes.
I didn't get a chance to meet him, unfortunately, but I have heard some of the music that you've shared with me and some of the stories you guys you know, some of the stories from the times you guys were working together and so on, and I have that to appreciate. So cool. May he journey into the other world peacefully.
Absolutely.
All right, so let's speak about music, spirituality, esoteric subjects, maybe the occult, etc. Obviously, you know, we're all familiar with some of the occult influences in rock and roll with Led Zeppelin. With speaking of Motley Crue and you know, some of the, like, their big hit, really, Shout at the Devil, some of the kind of images that they were playing with Black Sabbath and, you know, Dio and countless other, you know, bands. Deep Purple, I think, had a lot of esoteric and occult symbolism in their work. Blue Oyster Cult, Zeppelin, of course. Jimmy Page was a well-known fan of Crowley's work, and I think the tarot in general, but particularly Thelema and Crowley's brand of magic, and so on. And I think you know, there's, what's that book, actually? I don't remember the title. We were talking about this before. I think it was published a year or two ago, that book that was talking about rock and roll and the occult and how the occult saved the music business or something like this. Are you familiar with this, what I'm talking about? The title of this?
Sounds familiar.
I don't know why I reference, because I don't know the title.
Yeah, so
I do this. I do this
partial reference there.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give a partial reference right now. And since Mike, I am not in front of a computer and I don't like messing with my phone while we're doing the show, I will look that up and I will put that book in the description of the show, because it actually has a lot of really good information. I watched a couple of videos about it and so on, and the author did some really great deep investigative work on this very subject. That's not the only thing we're going to talk about, but I just wanted to kind of reference those ideas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously with the Beatles, there was a lot of esoteric influence from Maharishi and, you know, talking about meditation, the sort of mystical traditions of India that mm-hmm. helped to kind of bring that Eastern flavor of thought to the U.S. in the 60s. George Harrison, obviously, you know, as an option.
Jai Guru Deva Om.
Sure, right? I mean, this all, you know, music helped to bring a lot of these different traditions to the forefront. And now, you know, yoga, everybody knows yoga, meditation. It's like mainstream, you know, business as usual stuff now. And the whole, even the whole kind of new age market, you know, and this gigantic multi-billion-dollar new age business that's been created was from the seeds of this, you know, this musical and cultural revolution that took place during the 60s. I mean, we have to be honest about that. So, you know, it really, most of this comes out of that. Obviously, it's built on a lot more ancient foundations and, you know, Freemasonry and these esoteric movements and so on that, you know, that were there before. But I would say that popular music, especially rock and roll, really helped to popularize those movements. You know, Jimi Hendrix and the psychedelic experience, and then that, you know, goes into all the mind expansion stuff, into Terrence McKenna and, you know, and Leary and that whole, you know, kind of movement of psychedelia that even, you know, still is very, very popular today. Now it's, you know, moved more towards you know, DMT and some of these newer psychedelics. But, you know, there's still the old plant-based stuff, the mushroom stuff and the peyote and all that. So, you know, all this stuff comes out of 60s music. Let's be honest with ourselves. Rock and roll, for the most part, right?
I think so. And those, you know, two are linked. I mean, even the troubadours centuries ago were travelers, and they were magical in their own way. They had a whole, it was like a secret society. They had their own kind of cult together. So, music and mystical things, I think maybe what we also saw in the 60s was maybe a reuniting of those things that maybe had been more linked in the past with music.
Well, that's a great way to put it.
And philosophy and mysticism and even some spiritual study.
It was a resurrection as well, wasn't it? A resurrection of those things. Yeah.
Yeah. And so maybe it's in modern dress and modern drugs, I guess, and modern, electrical music, electrical guitars.
Yeah, for sure.
But maybe those seeds of those were, had maybe been lying dormant or something. But definitely what we see today and what we know today is a direct result of that renaissance, I guess, of the 60s.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even I think about my own life, for example. I know we're going to talk about your stuff as well. But in my own life, I mean, I was, pretty involved with music and, doing some singing and stuff. And nothing ever really took off. But I mean, I was very into the band scene and stuff in Seattle in the 90s at the time of the sort of grunge music thing. I hate to use that term grunge because it's kind of an outside term that threw onto it, but basically the Seattle music scene in the 90s and Pearl Jam, obviously Alice in Chains and Soundgarden and all those guys came out of that movement, Mudhoney and some of these other bands people might or might not be familiar with, Screaming Trees, etc., etc. So for me though, when I was playing, like a lot of the influence, and actually a lot of the influences on those bands were 60s rock and roll, and a lot of the arena rock and stuff from the 70s and then punk rock and so forth, but a lot of it drew on stuff that was from the 60s, at least for inspiration. And I know for myself, like one of the big influences for me, especially trying to write lyrics and trying to write poetry and stuff, was Jim Morrison. And then through Jim Morrison, from the Doors, I started reading Aldous Huxley, Doors of Perception. And then I began to read some of the French poetry of Baudelaire and Rimbaud, and kind of led down this rabbit hole of stuff. And there's a whole sort of mystical tradition going back to William Blake and even further back that is all kind of wrapped up in the sort of modern version of that, which is music and rock and roll. And even today, I mean, it goes on today, like the modern iterations of this would be like what's going on in the electronic music scene with, trance and I don't know all the different genres of electronic music by any means. But I know a lot of it is wrapped up in psychedelic and mind expansion stuff and different frequencies and harmonies and, the Pythagorean stuff and, the psychedelic experiences and so on. So it becomes a very sort of shamanic journey in a sense. The music itself kind of providing that container wherein, the expansion of consciousness takes place and starts to bloom out of, we place ourselves in that environment and around that particular harmony, around those energies of different people. Maybe it's a sort of rave like dance experience or whatever it is. So it continues even to this day. It continues even to this day. So getting back to you, I know even when, and for those of you that don't know and haven't read Chris's book or are not familiar with his music, Chris was in a band and, he played on Sunset Strip with a lot of those bands he was talking about earlier that Lizzie was involved with. There was a pretty tight-knit group of musicians back in the day in the 80s, right?
Yeah, it was a community of people.
A community.
For sure. And a lot of competition, but it was kept within the bounds of the community. That was never like a family.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
So I know for you, even though, you were doing a lot of partying in those years, obviously, and, probably living pretty recklessly as we all were in the 80s. You also had a sort of side to yourself that was more spiritual, and after shows and stuff like that, I mean, people would come to you and ask you advice and kind of like rap with you about different subjects, and, you know, and you guys would study together. I mean, kind of informally and stuff. Right. Mm-hmm. And you used to, what were some of the things you were reading back then and some of the things you were interested in?
Well, I read the Silver Mind Control Method in 1984. I was on tour and whacked out of speed in Phoenix of all places. And, I read that book just because to try to learn to meditate. My mom had done TM when I was a kid, and I never was allowed to do it. So, I just felt it was kind of weird. Plus I didn't feel like I was invited. So this was sort of my way of
well, you have to be initiated into TM to do it. So that's,
yeah.
And you weren't initiated, right?
No, no.
Okay. So there you go.
Okay. So no TM for you.
TM for you, partner. Yeah.
So I did the Silva thing, you know, basically actually just counting backwards from 10 on the breath and really focusing on that was about all I needed to come down from speed, because that was one of my drugs.
So choice. I love that your spiritual experience with meditation begins in. So I was trying to come down from speed and ..
Well, it worked. That's the thing.
That it
so
works.
I figured if it can,
by
if,
God.
If you're, you know, bouncing off walls and, you know, for 2.5 days, and this method can kind of bring you down to calmness. What if you're already semi-calm?
That's a great sales pitch for meditation right there, by the way. It's like, listen, if it can bring this guy down and talk him out of a tree, imagine
exactly
what it can do for a normal person like you.
Right?
Oh, that's beautiful.
Well, it was proof. I didn't have to believe anything. I tried it and it worked. And, you know,
well, that's what I tell people about meditation. It's one of these things. You don't need to believe in it. It's not like some kind of superstitious theory. You need to try it out. If it works, do it. If it doesn't work, don't do it. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I had always been interested in the big questions anyway, even as a little kid. You know, I was, you know, very interested in Egyptian things. I grew up in kind of an academic household, so we had a bunch of books and things around museums, for a family trip.
I grew up in a household where you got beat up if you carried around a book. So not in my own household, but outside the house. I can't tell you how many times I got in fights for carrying books around. You know what I mean? Anyway, so God bless you and your nurturing environment.
Well, you ended up embracing it in spite of your thing, and
I did.
Rejecting it.
Yeah.
Just despite my... Of course, I recaptured it later on. I'll fast forward a couple of years later. I'm living in L.A. and in Hollywood, just right across from the alley of the Cat House nightclub, this really notorious place where everybody went. So I'd go there at night and stumble home, after hours. And then the next day, I'm out sitting on the steps to this cruddy apartment building reading The Tao of Physics by Friedrich Capra. And I'm underlining things and I'm learning about quantum mechanics and, you know, so it was this parallel thing with the drugs and the partying, the Sunset Strip and the hairspray and everything else that was going on. And then I've got, you know, I'm reading Zen and I'm, Velikovsky. I got into Velikovsky and Worlds in Collision and some of these, you know, catastrophism theories of, of the Earth's history and how it affected culture. They were all very synthetic. There was a lot.
Did you read Von Daniken's book then too, the Ancient
Aliens? Well, I had seen a movie
there
when I was a kid when it came out in the '70s.
It's such a great movie. I love that movie.
Oh, and it blew me away. And I was just like, oh, of course, you know, I was a believer ever since. So
what? I forgot what is the title of that movie? That suddenly escaped
Chariots
me.
Chariots of the Gods.
Chariots of the Gods.
Mark. It's a
That's
question
right.
mark. It's not.
That's, yeah.
Theater, exclamation point. It's Chariots of the Gods.
thank you for that reading, because in case people didn't know what a question mark was, you just elucidated how we form questions in English.
Well,
it's
not a common movie
intonation.
You're
right.
You know?
Yeah.
Unless
no.
it's like Who Framed Roger Rabbit or something, maybe then that.
But you didn't
demand
the
question.
It's Who Framed Roger Rabbit. So sorry.
Exactly. See, you're getting it.
Now I'm getting it.
Yes.
I'm getting it. My ESL is starting to really pay off, my ESL learning. So anyway, I'm sorry. So I
just had this double life in a way, even within 24-hour period.
Yeah.
And to me, it was a balancing thing, and I never really let one or the other one go. It even got to the point where on tour, I'd be in some place in Arkansas or, you know, Massachusetts or wherever, and after the gig, people would come by, and I would do tarot and blow people away because obviously I had no prior knowledge or, you know, anything. So
what deck did you use, by the way, back then?
Just a Rider deck.
The Rider White?
Good, yeah, good deck.
That's a great beginner deck.
And I, you know, did it for a while there. I was doing it often enough that I could, you know, didn't even have to look at the cheat guide. I could, you know, lay my thing out. And
yeah.
But it's like, oh, how do you know that? Well, it's spot on, dude. You know, or something. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, even though they seemed like competing or parallel things, they intermingled
fit
and
together
mixed,
well, didn't and, they? Yeah.
And what blew me away is as I got, you know, more into studying history of philosophy and esoteric traditions, to find out really how linked it was back then to studies, you know, music and geometry and mathematics and astronomy all went together.
Yeah.
They weren't electives. Those were core and music, one of them, you know, because it was the math involved, very, very mathematical, as well as it is spiritual and ethereal and all these other things and feelings and vibrations.
Let me pop in really quickly on something, because you sent this to me and I absolutely love it. The Donald Duck video on Pythagorean mathematics and music, which is on YouTube. You can see the whole thing if you look up Donald Duck math magic, right?
Yes.
As one word, math magic. And it's Donald Duck traipsing around in this magical world. I think it's what's from the late 50s or something, or early 60s.
And yes, it that is, crappy era where, you know, animation looked really crappy. It looked really good in the 40s and 50s, and then it kind of got crappy anyway.
You know what? I actually like the way it looks. I like the, I don't know, there's something kind of kitschy and old school about it. I mean, especially now, you know,
it's very minimal. I think it was a minimalist.
The minimalist style. Yeah,
influence.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, the obviously the animation in something like a Snow White or something, I mean, those are masterpieces of artwork, but the 50s and 60s stuff that they did, especially for the educational stuff, it was a lot of fun. I dug it.
Yeah.
Anyway, that video is a really cool introduction to sort of sacred geometry, mathematics, Pythagorean thought, and so on. So if you have not seen it, please watch it. And what is amazing is think they actually used to show this in school. And, I mean, Donald Duck is being, like, initiated into Pythagorean wisdom, and he comes up with the sign of the pentagram on his on his hand. He actually has a hand at the end of his wings. Well, he doesn't have wings now that I think about it, but genius. The whole thing is genius. I don't think you could ever show that in school today, unless it were like at a Waldorf school or something, right? I mean, so anyway, I got completely off track, and I just wanted to share that with people because you sent me that link, and it reminded me. I did actually see that in school as well when I think I must have been in like third or fourth grade. Because it reminded me of that time, and I'm like, wait a minute, we watched this in school on a projector. They used to show films for you kids who are not aware, but films used to be films. They actually showed them on projectors on a screen in school. I mean, they have screens still, obviously, and they project things, but they're video projections now, and all of that, and everything's digital. But these were actually little films that they would run in school, and sometimes they would break, and sometimes they would burn. Remember when the film would burn, and then that you'd get that really neat pattern that would like go. But what sucked about that is then you didn't get to watch the movie unless
they had another copy.
Then you had to do some study, or read or some nonsense like that. So anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry. Pythagoras, the ancient world. Learning.
Sure. I kind of alluding to the Pythagorean, of course, we know the right triangle, the a squared plus b squared equals c squared, the Pythagorean theorem. We had to learn that about around that time too, although it's a little easier to swallow with Donald Duck given the lesson.
Indeed.
But the four schools, the four main schooling branches were based on number in the Pythagorean discipline. And the first one is just like arithmetic. that pure number. It's just numbers for numbers' sake, adding, subtracting, multiplying, dividing, all that stuff. Then there was number plus space, and that became geometry. So you have more, you know, two-dimensional, three-dimensional things. So we have number plus space. Then there was number plus time, and that was music. That when you talk about meter, there's a measure. They're called measures. One, two, three, one, two, three, two, you know, those mm-hmm. are each one of those, each block of threes, I guess, if you were doing a waltz, those are measures, and you measure things, and it's the meter, the time signature. So there's really the pitch, you know, the relation between the tones, even a guitar string, if you know, even a single string on a guitar, halfway through, if you hit the fret in the exact halfway point between, you know, the two ends of the string where it's stuck to the guitar, that's the octave. So cut it in half and you have an octave. There's all these proportions and they work every time. They're very mathematically sound, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. But that was so important. And then so astronomy, think, well, what does that have to do with music? Well, then with the harmony of the spheres. The music of the spheres, and it was back to astrotheology, where you have these seven planets, including the sun and moon, the ones that we can see from an Earth-centered perspective, and each one has a note. Those are the seven tones of the musical scale, the do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, and then do is the eighth, which is the octave, the first note repeated. So it works out just amazing in a mathematical sense. Where you think, oh gosh, music is, you know, it's all right brain. It's, you know, you're just listening, you know, you can close your eyes and you know, get carried away in the music, and you can, and it's great. And it's vibration and it transcends, it's the international language, mm-hmm. but it transcends language. But it's if you look under the hood, music is really, really mathematical.
Yeah.
A lot of science.
No, for sure. You know, at the end of that, Donald Duck thing, there's a Galileo quote, and I love that Disney actually the narrator says it in English, but they put up the Italian version of it from Galileo, which is la matematica e l'alfabeto nel quale Dio ha scritto l'universo, which is basically mathematics is the more or less like the alphabet that God created the world or wrote the world into being, something like that. With more or less, you know, the universe is written in mathematics. So, you know, that kind of thing is an amazing, you know, discovery, I guess, by human beings, that there's all these mathematical, you know, equations and precisions, you know, sort of underlying everything that we see. You know, speaking of that, they did a really neat job of visualizing taking the notes and showing those, the half, you know, the proportion and all that, and then kind of relating that to sacred geometry and balance and proportion in art and all of that. And you can see how like the vibrational qualities then also translate to visual beauty and balance and proportion in the nature and in you know, in nature itself, in the universe, you know, widely speaking. And then in the shapes that are found in creation, you know, in the star shapes and patterns and the spirals and the natural rectangular sort of proportion of things and all of these amazing connections, sacred geometry connections and so on. And all of that comes out of those same mathematical formulations and ideas that were found in music, right?
Right. They're so connected with, you know, with the early schooling that they couldn't escape it. There was no wonder they were hearing harmony of the spheres. Even Holst wrote a whole suite of orchestral music. You know, the planets, Mars, you know, Jupiter. They're to seven part, opus. Mm-hmm. The Mars one's kind of familiar. I think if you listen to that, you might go, "Oh, I've heard that maybe in a movie or something."
So Manly Hall talks a lot about Pythagoras and the secret teachings, and we haven't done a study on that, but I'd like to do that down the road. There's actually a great chapter on Pythagorean A Theory of Music and Color. It's chapter 17. I'm going to read a little bit of this because I like it. It's just the beginning portion of it. But I think later on we can do a show on this chapter alone if you're down for that.
Sure.
All right. So harmony is a state recognized by great philosophers as the immediate prerequisite of beauty. A compound is termed beautiful only when its parts are in harmonious combination. The world is called beautiful and its creator is designated the good because good perforce must act in conformity with its own nature, and good acting according to its own nature is harmony, because the good which it accomplishes is harmonious with the good which it is. Beauty, therefore, is harmony manifesting its own intrinsic nature in the world of form. In the world of form. So Manly Hall says very nicely and beautifully there about the connection between beauty and form and harmony, vibration and sound. You know, of course, we have the idea of the word as being, the creator of the, in the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, and the word was God. And that's the sort of creator of this vibrational idea, the idea that Om,
yes,
was, you know, or the vibratory force is what brought the universe into existence and so on. So vibration and form and beauty and the construction of this sort of physical reality we live in seem to be tied to vibration, to sound, to that sort of intentional movement of you know, that vibrational pattern, and so forth. So obviously there's a deep connection between sound, music, vibration, harmony, and our spiritual lives and this physical reality that we live in. You know, there's a certain harmony to anything that we find beautiful. And those ideas, they're ancient. But a lot of those ideas are found particularly in the Greek philosophy. Their ideas of beauty and balance and harmony and proportion and stuff were really brought to a high level in Greece. All right, that's going to about do it for the show today. Thank you again for joining us. Thank you for listening to this show on music, spirituality, the esoteric, et cetera, et cetera. We covered a lot of ground, and we hope that it was an enjoyable ride for you guys. May Lizzie Gray rest in peace. Thank you for sharing your stories about him and about rock and roll in LA, Chris. Appreciate it.
Sure.
We will be here each week, actually twice a week now. We do our midweek show, which is a little more free form. Thank you for joining us again. As I said, please support us if you can. We're at anchor.fm/cosmiceye. Chris's website is chrissheridan.com. The Cosmic Eye website is at cosmiceye.org. Chris is the author of Spirit in the Sky. I am the author of If You Can't Worry, You Can Meditate. So check out our stuff if you get a chance. Thanks again for joining us. We will be here again soon. And Chris, thank you. Appreciate your help.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, everybody have a great week. Goodbye and God bless.